All right, our third case this morning is 2019-1103, the State of Ohio versus David Carl Kinney. For the appellant, Mr. Gagin.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I wish to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. By statute, Ohio grants every convicted felon the right to appeal their sentence except for two. Through the good work now of the amicus curiae in this case, it's now undisputed that Ohio is the only state in the nation to deny appellate review of aggravated murder and murder sentences. This case, therefore, asks the court to determine whether the statute that imposes that unique sentencing practice, Revised Code Section 2953.08d3, violates Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution and the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution as a cruel and unusual punishment. But before I address the constitutional issue, I would like to address the question as to why. Why is it that Ohio stands alone in this particular sentencing practice? And again, the source of Ohio's anomalous sentencing practice is found within the statute's legislative history. Summarizing that, from 1996, July 1st of 1996 until March 2nd of 2005, Ohio had but one sentence a trial court could impose for aggravated murder and murder, which was 20 to life. Under the former 2903. Consequently, when 2953.08 became effective on July 1st in 96 as part of Senate Bill 2's sentencing reform, it included Division D, which took away the right of appeal for anyone convicted of aggravated murder or murder. And I would submit that at that time, that was a rational choice. There was but one sentence, 20 to life, with no discretion for the trial court. One size fit all, everyone got the same sentence. There was nothing to appeal. To allow an appeal would have been to allow a superfluous act. But that changed.
Well, counsel, to allow an appeal based of the sentence is one thing, but to flatly deny an appeal for a host of other reasons, other errors at trial, et cetera, how is that justified?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, under D3, it was simply the sentence that for an aggravated murder or murder that was denied appellate jurisdiction.
So all the other appeals are on the table.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. Correct, Your Honor. 2953.08a grants the right to appeal a felony sentence in Ohio. And then D3 takes it away just for aggravated murder and for murder. And again, historically, as we're going through this, Substitute House Bill 184 in 2004 added additional discretionary sentences. We went from just 20 to life. We had 20 to life, 25 to life, 30 to life, and LWOP, life without parole. But for whatever reason, the General Assembly did not adjust its sentencing practice to permit an aggravated murder or murder individual that's been convicted of that to appeal their sentences.
Counselor, do you think it was just sheer oversight?
Your Honor, I know the amicus curiae have sort of said that there was no way that the General Assembly could have intended that outcome. I think part of the problem, though, with that, quite honestly, is that this case, this court's opinion in Porterfield said that that statute meant what it said. And originally, it was Division D. And when they amended it, they then made it, they separated it out because of the potential ambiguousness issue relative to it. So practically speaking, the General Assembly had to physically address that very issue. So I think from my perspective, for Mr. Kinney, I think it's difficult for us to say that they didn't think about it in terms of creating that statutory scheme, if you will.
Counsel, you in your briefs, you tend to rely also on Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution. Was that actually raised below? Because the appellate court doesn't seem to think so.
Well, the answer to the justice's question is yes, I did raise that here. I do see this as a new federalism type of case where the Ohio Constitution provides a broader protection than the Eighth Amendment alone. The issue was essentially raised below, but keep in mind, under Porterfield, the Seventh District Court of Appeals had no appellate jurisdiction to consider anything relative to the sentence itself. So I submit that it has been raised. And I would also submit, as the amicus curiae pointed out in this case, that is not a new issue. We're not raising it. It may be considered a new argument, but it is not a new issue. And that is permissible. In fact, the state in Lingle versus State, and another parallel case to this, has argued that it's more important for the court to get the law right on those types of issues. So the state has gone to great lengths to argue that we seek a declaration of a constitutional right of appeal to a felony sentence. We do not. That issue is well settled. There is no constitutional right to an appellate review of a criminal sentence. This court has agreed in State v. Smith on that. But Ohio grants that right of appeal statutorily, and then it further punishes only aggravated murder and murder convictions with a further punishment by taking that right that is statutorily granted to everyone else in the state convicted of a felony. They take that right away. And this raises an Eighth Amendment problem, because as this court and the Supreme Court have acknowledged, that once the right of appeal is established, even though it doesn't have to be established, but once it is established, then these avenues must be kept free of unreasoned distinctions that can only impede open and equal access to the court.
So that sounds to me more like an equal protection challenge. Was that raised?
So, Your Honor, the equal protection argument has been one that I'm sure the court has seen that the parties have gone a bit round and round with. I want to explain that. This is a good opportunity to do that. So, first of all, as the Supreme Court case law indicates, equal protection, because the Eighth Amendment is made applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment, they are said to be somewhat interwoven, both due process and equal protection within an Eighth Amendment analysis. So I don't, from my perspective, on behalf of Mr. Kinney, I don't see how one eliminates the other. They're interwoven, as the Supreme Court has said. I also think it's important to understand sort of the distinctions, if you will, of positions. I actually obviously have a real client. Mr. Kinney was sentenced to LWOP. And when you look at the LWOP analysis, it has problems in Ohio that I do believe violate the both Article 1, Section 1, and Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution, as well as the Eighth Amendment, because LWOP allows one judge one time with a discretionary sentence, and there is never another review of that sentence. And I do believe that becomes an arbitrarily administered sentencing practice that is prohibited. That's different from, say, the amicus curiae in this, who are taking the broader view, where you would have, say, an aggravated murderer sentenced to 25 to life or 28 to life with a gun spec. My Eighth Amendment analysis says that because there is an administrative review available to those individuals, that the statute D3 might survive an Eighth Amendment analysis and challenge for anyone not sentenced to LWOP. But I think LWOP is unique in this case. We have the whole issue about death is different, and I understand that. But in this particular circumstance,
do we have to get to your argument at all? I mean, what about 2953.02? Doesn't that give you a right to appeal?
Well, that's certainly what the state has argued. They called that the general.
Well, they haven't. They've argued that. They say it hasn't. But
well, I understand. They raised the issue as to whether, I think the in my understanding of it, the question is really, does the court have to address that issue before it gets to the constitutional issue? I would say no.
If there's a right to appeal, there's a right to appeal. We kind of have to address that first.
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. Honestly, ultimately, the Solicitor General's analysis is correct. There is, because D3 is a specific reference to aggravated murder and the appellate sentences, that would supersede the general appellate law that the justice.
Well, even under, if you say there's a constitutional problem, shouldn't we see if there's a statutory way to, before we get to this constitutional issue? I mean,
obviously, if the court can address an issue prior to reaching the constitutional issue, it is required to do so. In this particular case, though, I think you go back to State versus Porterfield, where this court said, you know, D3 means what it says. It says there is no appellate jurisdiction for aggravated murder.
What does that language mean in 08 that says in addition to any other right to appeal?
Well, again,
What's the language mean in 02 that says there's a right to appeal a criminal sentence?
Well, under what? 151, the statutory construction, I believe, as you go through it, is going to say that the specific will control the general. And there's no question that 02
doesn't have to be a conflict for the specific to control over the general? I mean, is there a conflict here?
Well, it would be a conflict. If
why is that?
Well, if 02 says there's a right to appeal a felony sentence, and then D3 says there's no right to appeal a felony sentence in instances of aggravated murder.
It says there's no right to appeal under this section. It says, and the statute says in addition to any other right to appeal. That doesn't seem like a conflict to me.
Well, again, that would suggest that Porterfield would have to be overruled before you could get to that conclusion, Your Honor. So where that leaves us, I believe, is that let me do it this way. Let me address the Article 1, Section 1, the new federalism issue. I did not cite State versus Mole, 149 Ohio State 3rd, 215, which is the 2016 case, or Arnold versus Cleveland, 67 Ohio State 3rd, 35. That's a 1993 case. That is to my discredit. But it is relevant because this court has said on multiple occasions that the Ohio Constitution is a document of independent force relative to the federal Constitution. And relative to Mr. Kinney's LWOP sentence, Article 1, Section 1 gives every Ohioan the inalienable right to enjoy and defend their life and liberty. And under D3, there is no right to defend that life or liberty. Mr. Kinney, despite his conviction, I will say to anyone that will listen, is not an evil man. He had no prior issues with the law. He didn't have a drug problem.
Didn't your client have a right to defend his life and liberty at trial?
Well, I would say to you, he has the right to defend his guilt or innocence at trial. But of course, sentencing then becomes sort of a separate phase of that prosecution process.
But counsel is entitled to argue about sentence.
Well, I think there's a practical issue, though, Your Honor. If D3 means what it says, as this court said in Porterfield, what difference does it make if you try to put on a sentencing issue? Because regardless of the sentence, it's non-reviewable. Right? So, I mean, in some ways, why would a prosecutor ever charge somebody with a death penalty and give them the rights of appeal and the years of appeal? Right? Why not just sentence them to LWOP, which is not, or any other sentence, which is non-reviewable, even if the judge in question was overtly using an improper motivation for the sentence or was not following Ohio's sentencing guidelines. There's right now, it is beyond review under the statutory construction, again, which Porterfield lays down. In looking at time, I would like to just reference a remedy in this case. I do believe that the remedy of severance is the appropriate remedy under Revised Code 150. I believe that this can be cured simply by striking Revised Code Section 295308D3 in its entirety. I understand the court might... I think there is an interesting dichotomy, though. If the court were to make an Eighth Amendment analysis, it might not strike it all down because only LWOP arguably would violate the Article 1, Section 9 and Eighth Amendment. But the removal of that paragraph would fit in the larger equal protection argument that is advanced. Again, that's beyond my particular client, but it is within the realm of the amicus in this case, and they have agreed with that potential. It's a very simple, quick way to remedy what is clearly an unconstitutional sentencing practice. I would also say that Mr. Kinney, therefore, because there is no ability to appeal the sentence, once you're convicted, you're classified. And regardless of your individual characteristics, your appeal is then beyond review. And so at that point, I think it has to go back to the trial court for resentencing, to put on a full sentencing hearing at that point with all mitigating factors. And then we would proceed with the appeal, just as the state of Ohio provides for every other convicted felon in the state.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin with a really important clarification and then a factual correction that goes to the why question. Why do we do it this way? First, the clarification. We agree that there's no right to appeal a sentence, but that does not mean these sentences are beyond review. There are several ways to do that, and every single avenue would allow a defendant to capture the horrific scenario in which a judge gives life without parole versus parole after 20 years because of race or sexual orientation or something of that manner. And I would add that if they were to seek relief on that basis and the trial court erred in that respect, our office would be here arguing that the judge should be removed from the case and probably the bench. But putting that aside, what are these avenues for relief? First, a writ of mandamus. If the judge were to rely on something like that, there'd be a clear entitlement to mandamus relief for a resentencing before a new judge. They could also go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court with a writ of certiorari. You can seek a writ of cert from the highest court and the highest from the last state court that is able to issue a ruling. Finally, they can seek disqualification before the Supreme Court of Ohio. All that brings me to the why. Why is it structured this way? Well, because aside from the scenarios we're talking about where a judge relies on race or something, there is no situation in which the imposition of a sentence of life, of any version of a life sentence, without parole, with parole, will ever be arbitrary or unjustified. And I also want to correct, that brings me to the statutory history point. The amici, to some extent, though they walk back from this in a footnote, and Kinney both say that the previous version of the law allowed only one sentence for aggravated murder. That is false. I invite you to look at the law that was on the books at the time. There was one sentence for life without parole with no capital specifications. But if there were capital specifications, there was a range of sentences available: life without parole, parole after 25, parole after 30. So that entire argument that this was an oversight or something of that nature is built on a false premise. That is simply that it was not the law then, and it doesn't explain why the statute says what it says today. So the reason, again, the General Assembly did it this way is because they recognized, or at least they had a rational basis to conclude, that the truly egregious abuses of judicial power could be corrected through mandamus, through disqualification, and otherwise there was no reason to burden courts with bickering about whether a trial court should have decided to impose parole after some number of years or life without parole. Simply put, death is different. When you as an adult...
What was the range of sentences available to the trial court?
For aggravated murder?
In this case.
It would be life without parole after 20, 25, or 30. I'm sorry, life with parole after 20, 25, or 30, or life without parole.
So that gave the trial court a great deal of discretion, and presumably he, in making the decision he did, he applied 29-29-11 and 29-29-12, listened to the arguments. What did the state advocate for at the sentencing hearing?
Life without parole, and the court gave the reasons for imposing life without parole, which
okay. So is there any other law on the books where a discretionary decision like that wouldn't be reviewable? Just to make sure there wasn't an abuse of discretion by the trial court judge in making that decision.
And I think the key point is it would be reviewable in mandamus, but what the General Assembly recognized is there will be no situation in which there will be just a normal old abuse of discretion that would justify an appellate court overruling a trial court who heard the witnesses, saw the defendant's demeanor, and decided that one version of a life sentence is different. Is more justified than another. Again,
what about a constitutional question that comes in from a life sentence? Say, I mean, I heard you say that. Well, there really can't be an Eighth Amendment issue. But what if there was an equal protection issue? What if there was, discrimination based on race?
Right. That
I mean, could mean. Do you think that took the jury? You think there's no jurisdiction to hear that case? And it's in the Court of Appeals or this court, except on mandamus?
Well, except on mandamus, you could seek disqualification. You could go directly to the Supreme Court of the United States. I don't think there'd be a direct right to it.
What about the provision in the Ohio Constitution that talks about this court's jurisdiction over constitutional cases arising under the state or federal constitution?
Oh, absolutely. This court has jurisdiction over this case, and so it is able to review the question. But what it's doing is...
isn't your view that, well, that we don't have jurisdiction to decide these issues unless the Court of Appeals does?
Yes, that is our view in an appeal. Of course, there could be mandamus, and I don't see why that wouldn't be an adequate remedy here. It's effectively de novo review of the
What about the Ohio constitutional provision, though?
The Ohio constitutional provision says that this court will have jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction, to review any criminal case. And the court will exercise that by reviewing the judgment below. But the only way to review that is to affirm it, because they correctly held that they had no jurisdiction. But I would add that if this court does have jurisdiction to review the sentence, then his Eighth Amendment claim or any constitutional claim necessarily fails, because it means he does have a right to an appeal, which is the antecedent question that's never been, that wasn't adequately briefed below.
I mean, why wouldn't we say that 2953.808 deals with challenges based on, say, the judge's use of discretion within the statutory mandated range, and under that section, those kind of decisions aren't appealable, but the Court of Appeals can still hear constitutional challenges?
Well, I think what the court could say is if it's true that at least the felony appeal statute does not permit reviews of abuses of discretion, then Mr. Kinney's claim fails and this court has to affirm, because he has not argued that his sentence is unconstitutional or that it was unconstitutionally imposed. He apparently wishes to challenge the exercise of discretion. So I think what the court could do is affirm the Seventh District and say that at least in cases like this, where there's not an underlying constitutional challenge to the sentence, the appellate courts lack jurisdiction, and leave for another day what would happen in this, hopefully never does happen, case where a judge imposes a sentence based on race or sexual orientation or something of that nature. But back to the merits, the court granted review to determine whether the Eighth Amendment or Article 1, Section 9 guarantees a right to an appeal. Now, I heard my friend say there is no right to an appeal, which I think should end that question. He says the Equal Protection Clause is somehow tied up in the Eighth Amendment. The entire basis for that is a 1972 concurrence from Justice Douglas. It is not the law in the Supreme Court. It is not the law in this court, and it doesn't make any sense. The Eighth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 speak to punishments. They don't speak to procedures. So to try to fit this case into the Eighth Amendment rubric, he says that denying the right to an appeal is a punishment. But if that's the case, so is every other procedure that governs post-trial, the post-trial management of a case upon a conviction and sentence, page limits, the deadline for filing a notice of appeal. All of those things would constitute punishments that could be challenged. Now, they might be upheld, but they would still constitute punishments. That is not the way this court or the Supreme Court has ever talked about the matter. Further, let's assume it's a punishment. Even if it is a punishment of sorts, it wouldn't be a cruel and unusual one. Cruel and unusual punishment is a very high bar. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that the electric chair doesn't count. I would submit that if the electric chair is not a cruel and unusual punishment, neither is the denial of a right to an appeal of a judge's exercise of discretion when you can seek review through mandamus or writ of certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think where all this leaves us is with two possible ways to resolve this case. The first is to say the felony appeal law doesn't permit appeals of a judge's exercise of discretion. And we don't have to decide, we can leave for another day, whether the court can review a constitutional flaw in the sentence. If that's the case, the only option here is to affirm, because he has not argued that the sentence was imposed unconstitutionally.
Counselor, what would be the General Assembly's motivation or the state's motivation for having unfettered discretion of the trial court in this instance, not to be reviewed by an appellate court? What public policy is served by that?
The public policy is the same one, I think, that motivates the Supreme Court's death penalty jurisprudence, which is that death is different. When you as an adult take another human life, the U.S. Supreme Court said, you engage in a crime that's different in kind, not simply in degree. And so because of that,
But we have appeals all the time where people have taken other people's lives and they're sentenced to consecutive sentences. We review those and still a life is taken. What's the difference?
So that's step one, is that this crime is unique in its severity. And because of its severity, and this is where I get to the rational basis, no version of a life sentence will ever be problematic. If you take a human life, you have no legitimate grounds, except for the extraordinary unconstitutional bases we've been discussing, for complaining about a sentence of life without parole versus a sentence of life.
But counselor, we have sentences all the time where after consecutive services there, we have, 50-year-olds being sentenced to 80 years in prison. That's life, right? And we review those, and there's no death involved.
Right. I think the death involved is the death involved in the fact that every sentence available to this person is per se legitimate is what makes an appeal a waste of judicial resources. And that's the rational basis.
Now, every murder is terrible. I'll give you that. But what are the facts in the record that support the most severe penalty short of the death penalty in this particular case? Why was Mr. Kenny, based on this factual scenario, considered the worst of the worst?
Well, Mr. Kinney's crime was premeditated, and let me explain how we get to this particular sentence and what the trial court said. He lured a person he loved, admittedly, back to a home with the intent to kill him. That's what the jury found aggravated murder. He then murdered this individual whom he loved. If you can take the life of someone you care deeply about, you're particularly dangerous and the crime's especially heinous. Now, not only did he commit the murder, but he carried on with the rest of his day and went about trying to cover it up. He was texting with friends in a jocular way. He went home with his family. He helped his wife dye her hair. She said there was no sign that he was nervous or otherwise troubled. Again, a sign of a dangerous human being. Then what he did is he went back to the crime scene with his wife and their child, a young child, to have them come upon the body to make it look as though he had discovered the murder and not taken part in it. Then what he did is to try to set up three more people, one of the victim's previous boyfriends and two other people who had, built a fence on the property. Then he set about lying about it for 2 days in furtherance of this scheme before it was eventually busted. And so what the court said is that showed someone who is particularly cold, particularly calculating, and is going to be a danger to society at any age. That's why life without parole was imposed.
And there are those who would say he should have gotten the death penalty.
Well, the death penalty wasn't sought, but the...
Exactly. Therein lies the issue. You have the discretion of the prosecutors, one person, oftentimes, and then the trial court judge. And so had the death penalty been sought and he had been convicted and sentenced to death, he would have an appeal, correct?
He would, because we specifically provide for that. The reason being, frankly, the U.S. Supreme...
And with the exact set of facts, the exact same set of facts, what makes the scenario different other than how the prosecutor chooses to prosecute?
And so then, here's the key. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The key difference is that under U.S. Supreme Court case law, even as to murderers, the death sentence may sometimes be unconstitutional. There is no circumstance in which life without parole as applied to a murderer or any life sentence is unconstitutional. And so for that reason, there's no need for this prophylactic to prevent the imposition of an unconstitutional.
You say there's no scenario, and yet you say earlier that a defendant has the opportunity to file a writ of mandamus or some other higher hurdle for review that might be deemed, where trial court's decision might be deemed unconstitutional.
It's a
different mechanism.
I'll try to clarify my answer. Aside from the circumstances in which the sentence is imposed unconstitutionally, which has nothing to do with the sentence itself, but the way in which it's imposed, aside from those circumstances, which will all be resolved through mandamus, I think easily, there is no circumstance in which someone convicted of aggravated murder can complain about a life sentence.
How do you say easily if, like you said before, some unlawful reason, age, race, et cetera, is not set forth by the trial court, and it's just that trial court's judge's own biases that never come out on the record? How is that proven in a mandamus action?
It would be easier to prove in a mandamus action than a direct appeal, because the mandamus action, this court could order a brief from the trial court. If it's not on the record, that's a hopeless appeal. It would have to be post-conviction relief. So that circumstance will never arise in a direct appeal. But I see my time is running up, and I just want to suggest two possible ways to affirm this. One, and the one, or resolve this case. The one we advocate for most obviously in the brief is to simply hold that there is no constitutional right to an appeal, full stop. But if the court doesn't want to go that far, I think Justice DeWine, your questions suggested one possibility, which is to leave open the question whether the felony appeal law would permit an appeal of an unconstitutionally imposed sentence or one that has constitutional flaws, and simply say that at least in cases where no unconstitutionality is the basis for the appeal, you can't challenge the choice of discretion between life without parole, life with parole after 20 years, 25, or 30. And if there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm this evidence.
I have one question. Prior to 2953-08's enactment, could someone challenge a sentence on constitutional grounds?
So when we looked for this, we found cases where it was done, but no assessment of jurisdiction. The court has said that the general appeal law, before the statute's enactment, you couldn't challenge a felony appeal. And so I think the answer was no, although sometimes it happened. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honor, just a couple quick points.
Counselor, use your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Couple quick points. First, this was never a capital case, so the capital specs and the additional sentences that my friend referenced as providing additional sentences, discretionary sentences, are not applicable. I will tell the court, having been there, that the state of Ohio did not make a recommendation of LWOP. In fact, the elected prosecutor showed up for the sentencing and stood moot. Other than a general statement, the trial counsel did not participate in the sentencing hearing. I would also tell you that what the state seems to be suggesting is they want the court to rewrite D3 in a way that fits its policy narrative. That is left for the General Assembly. I don't believe we can go down that road. And then finally, there's no question that Mr. Kinney made some grievous mistakes, but even if you take everything, this all happened in a 16-minute span of time. There's no evidence he brought a gun. There's no evidence that there were threats. Most of the trial court's conclusions, if you will, had no bearing with what was actually proven. In fact, the forensic evidence in there left grave doubts. It proved conclusively that the crime could not, or the shooting could not have happened in the way Mr. Kinney ultimately, quote, confessed to. He said that after there was an initial argument, pushing, shoving, a shot fired, and Mr. McGarry fell, he then stood over him at 6'6" and fired one shot in a split second. Physically, that was impossible. There was the forensic evidence showed that the bullet wound in the back of the head had to have been fired from close range. And the second shot almost missed. It just went between the scalp and the skull, which would indicate, given all of that, that there was a struggle involved. This was not an execution style killing. Now, again, we have to live with what he did after the fact, but that's the point. It's all after the fact. There is no indication in his record or in his history, even if you think he deserves, say, 30 to life. But I guarantee you that if we brought his record from prison right now, he is a model prisoner. There are no issues. There is no need to protect the public from Mr. Kinney long term.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?